This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Patrick Labuda about his book titled International Criminal Tribunals and Domestic Accountability in the Court's Shadow, published by Oxford University Press. This book does a really interesting deep dive and investigation of international criminal tribunals, many of which popped up in the 1990s around, for example, Rwanda or Srebrenica or things like that. But there are more than just those. There's actually kind of a whole system going on, which has some really interesting political effects, political interactions, and much more. So, Patrick, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Hi, Miranda. Thanks so much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm currently a researcher on the Mimocracy Project at the Polish Academy of Sciences. I'm actually a lawyer and historian by training. The project looks at memory from a regional perspective, Eastern European perspective. I'm a lawyer and a historian, and I've always kind of been more interested in the social aspects of law, how law operates in society, also sort of the political dimensions of law. And this kind of naturally got me interested in international law, which is a more political field of law. And you know, that what's interesting about this is that I actually came to international law more as a practitioner. So I was sent to work in the Democratic Republic of Congo, then Sudan and South Sudan. And then based on sort of my experience in those contexts, I decided to go back and write a PhD. This book that we're going to discuss is actually based on sort of the PhD research that I did, but then that builds also on my professional experience in several African countries.
Very interesting combination. Thank you for giving us that background. It's not surprising to me, especially hearing that this book does what books that I tend to like do, which is kind of poke at something and go, hang on, we've got some assumptions. Maybe we need to take more of a look at them. So can you tell us what assumptions your book is interrogating and why you think they need investigation?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. I mean, the assumption is really something that I came across in my work. So when I was actually working as a practitioner I was based at the time in the Democratic Republic of Congo, working on justice reform, broadly speaking. And one assumption that I came across a lot was that that complementarity is a positive thing. Complementarity is something that I'll explain in a moment, but it's really this idea that justice for the most serious crimes should be done domestically. So it's better if we do justice for serious crimes like genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity at the national level, closer to the victims, closer to the site of the crimes. I have to admit that when I was sent to this context, so first to the DR Congo, but then later on I was in Sudan and South Sudan, where this assumption was also very common, I found it a little counterintuitive. I found it counterintuitive for two reasons. The first being that, you could see the challenges that the justice systems in those countries faced. And then the second issue was myself. I come from a post-authoritarian context, so from Poland, where, you know, I was very aware of the fact that we struggled to deal with the past, deal with crimes committed in the past. Our justice system really struggled with these issues. So I found this assumption that justice should be done domestically, ideally, and then, you know, international institutions like the International Criminal Court should only step in as a backstop, a little counterintuitive. And so that got me thinking about complementarity, about sort of the relationship between the international and the domestic. And that's kind of how the project was born. You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, I later decided to write a PhD about that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for kind of going into that in a bit more detail. Can we now kind of poke at that even further and tell us what you mean by positive complementarity and why you think it became so dominant?
Yeah, so complementarity is really a bit of a buzzword. For international lawyers, for lawyers generally, I think, you know, this is a word that we hear a lot, but maybe for people who are not necessarily trained as lawyers, it might be worth unpacking this. I mean, it's a bit of an empty signifier. It's a word that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And that's partly by design, though the word is not even in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And yet everybody who works on international criminal law in this field knows what it means. And so it's a bit surprising, if you think about it that way, that a word that's not even in the document that is sort of the foundation of the International Criminal Court is a word that describes the court's operations. And, you know, in a nutshell, the idea behind complementarity is that states, domestic justice systems have priority to prosecute. And only if they do not, you know, if they fail to prosecute international crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, for whatever reason, lack of capacity, lack of political will, or they just don't feel like prosecuting domestically, that's when the International Criminal Court, you know, the international level will step in. So it's a bit like in global governance scholarship, it's a bit like subsidiarity. It's this idea that you do things at the domestic level and then the international level steps in if, you know, if the domestic level can't handle it. Now, positive complementarity, now more specifically in the international criminal law context, is thought of as something positive. So complementarity, positive complementarity. For me, some lawyers try to make distinctions between these terms, but I think positive complementarity and complementarity are essentially the same thing. And it's this idea that this relationship between the international and the domestic level is something good. It's a good thing. It's better than the alternatives because it encourages states to prosecute. The international level, the International Criminal Court, casts a shadow over states. It encourages them to prosecute. It helps them to build their domestic capacity. It helps states to reform their domestic legislation. And so, in general, it is a positive relationship. And you know, the only thing I'll mention is that complementarity was born in sort of the negotiations leading up to the Rome Statute, which is the treaty that created the International Criminal Court. But since then, it's become sort of this, as I said earlier, a buzzword. It's sort of an empty signifier that's applied to different tribunals, not just the International Criminal Court. When people talk about the Special Court for Sierra Leone or the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, for the former Yugoslavia, these are all different international criminal tribunals, and yet they don't have complementarity in their statutes, but the word is applied to them because it's become a general term to describe the relationship between tribunals and the domestic level.
And as you've just helpfully explained, that has some problems, that has some weaknesses beyond just the kind of, the looseness of the use of the term really being a big one. You helpfully in the book provide an alternative way of thinking about this, and especially of kind of talking about and using this language. Can you introduce us to your alternative vocabulary and framework for these interactions?
Sure. So I, one of the claims that the book makes, but I'm not the first person to say this. In fact, you know, there are many scholars who have identified sort of the problems with the language of complementarity, that it's vague, it misleads potentially. But one of the things that this book does, and you know, where hopefully it makes a small contribution to the literature, is that it provides an alternative way of thinking about these questions. So instead of using complementarity as a word to describe different relationships between international tribunals and domestic actors, domestic courts, domestic prosecutors, domestic civil society, it proposes a tripartite typology of relations. It's a framework. And I propose three different terms to describe the different things that complementarity does. One is iteration, accommodation, and isolation. So iteration is sort of this idea. It refers to kind of push-pull relationships, interactions between states and international criminal tribunals, where the two levels, so the international and the domestic, adjust their behavior in response to what the other level is doing. The other idea is accommodation. And so this is sort of a consensual relationship where both levels decide not to interfere with one another's work. So they're not really challenging one another. They're operating side by side, but it's a very consensual relationship. And then isolation is sort of a more antagonistic, hostile relationship where disagreements between the two levels lead to, potentially even a breakdown of cooperation. The most extreme example of which would be withdrawals from the Rome Statute. So there are a few states that have decided we don't like what the International Criminal Court is doing, and therefore we are just going to put an end to our cooperation. We're going to withdraw from the founding treaty, and we are no longer playing this game. So that's isolation. And obviously, you know, these three labels, so iteration, accommodation, and isolation, these are ideal types. These are ideal types that I propose as an alternative way of thinking about what is usually described as complementarity. And you know, essentially, to kind of summarize the book's argument, the argument is that when people talk about complementarity, they usually think of iteration. That's kind of the natural association that people make. And that's why I described it as a positive, a healthy relationship where, you know, the international and the national levels are interacting with one another. They're adjusting their behavior in response to what the other level is doing. But my argument is that, in fact, in practice, if we look at the different international tribunals and how they've operated, most of it is accommodation. There's a bit of isolation. There's a bit of iteration, but most of it is actually accommodation. So, you know, the framework is, it's trying to kind of reframe how we think about these questions.
Hmm. Thank you for introducing it to us and giving us kind of that big picture overview, because I now want to get into the details of what this kind of helps us better understand on the ground. Can we start with Sierra Leone?
Sure. So I think it's really helpful to kind of unpack what this means in practice, because of course, especially for people who have not necessarily studied international criminal law, the statutes of international tribunals, all that might sound quite vague. But let's take a case like the Sierra Leone. So Sierra Leone is a country where mass crimes happened In the 1990s, there was a civil war from the early 1990s up until 2002. And at some point, this was before the International Criminal Court was established, there was a decision made to create the Special Court for Sierra Leone. So the Special Court for Sierra Leone was established in 2002 to deal with crimes that were committed before 1998. 1998 was when the Rome Statute came into force, but like I just said, it was too late for the International Criminal Court to deal with most of the crimes committed in Sierra Leone. And, you know, a principle of criminal law is that you should not apply criminal law retroactively. And therefore, the ICC could not deal with these crimes. Now, the Special Court for Sierra Leone had something that's called in the literature a hybrid mandate, right? So it's not complementarity. Complementarity is this relationship that we find in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, but the Special Court for Sierra Leone had something experts usually refer to this as a hybrid mandate. And the idea behind this hybrid mandate is very actually similar in many ways to complementarity. It's this idea that by mixing the international and the domestic, so by mixing elements of international and domestic law in the mandate of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, by putting this hybrid court in Sierra Leone so close to the site of the crimes, there would be a spillover effect. There would be a positive effect on the domestic justice system in Sierra Leone. The victims would see justice done closer to home, and therefore there would be this special court for Sierra Leone would have a beneficial impact on justice in that country. And you know what this book does is it uses interviews, it assesses the literature, but it also uses interviews with different stakeholders in Sierra Leone to understand whether that happened. And I'm going to just give two examples to illustrate what did and did not happen. I mean, so one example is the co-location of personnel. So the Special Court for Sierra Leone hired not just international prosecutors, judges, and experts, but also Sierra Leonean prosecutors, judges, investigators. And this is different from other tribunals. At other tribunals, oftentimes you would not involve local staff, people from the country where the crimes were committed, because there was a feeling that that would somehow taint the process. In Sierra Leone, for the first time, that option was directly in the mandate. And the idea there was that, okay, we are going to build the capacity of the Sierra Leonean justice system. Another thing that was put in that in the statute of the Sierra Leone Special Court was that the court, the prosecutor of that court would have the power to prosecute not just international crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, but also certain ordinary Sierra Leonean crimes, so murder. I forget now what were the specific crimes from the Sierra Leonean justice system. But there, again, the idea was that by putting both types of crimes in the statute, we would also, the special court would be indirectly encouraging domestic prosecutors to take ownership of this whole process and to emulate a little bit what the special court was doing at the international level for the Sierra Leonean prosecutors on their end to also try and prosecute certain serious crimes domestically. Now, what my framework does is, so this is kind of bringing it back to the overarching framework of the book, it allows us to unpack whether this happened or not. I mean, hybridity, the hybrid mandate, as I just explained, the idea was that these things would happen. But if you look a little closer, you realize that the Special Court for Sierra Leone didn't really have this iterative impact. So the idea of iteration here, that there would be a push-pull relationship between the domestic and the international level, it didn't really happen that way. You know, to give just a few examples, oftentimes Sierra Leonean domestic staff, as soon as they were hired by the international court, by the special court, they would then go on to more lucrative positions elsewhere. They would not return to the domestic justice system to share sort of their expertise with local magistrates. Another problem is that some of the crimes that were prosecuted by the special court, they were just too different from what domestic prosecutors were doing. And so in the end, this knowledge that was acquired through the special court was not really, didn't filter back into the domestic justice system. Another problem is that the special court, in many ways, it didn't encourage domestic prosecutors to prosecute domestically. On the contrary, the effect was that, in a way, the domestic judges, prosecutors felt like, okay, we don't have to do this because somebody else is taking care of it. So it almost had this dissuasive effect, which I call isolation, a negative sort of dissuasive effect on the domestic justice system. So, generally speaking, the way the special court interacted with the Sierra Leonean domestic justice system did not really conform to these expectations that were embedded in the special court's mandate. This hybrid mandate was supposed to have this spillover effect on the domestic justice system. But in practice, instead of iterative relationships, we had isolationist almost relationships. There was some accommodation there between the two levels, but it didn't have this anticipated spillover effect.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So what you've just sort of taken us through with Sierra Leone, I think, is, as you said, a really helpful understanding, not just of kind of what was meant to happen, but what actually did happen. What about in Rwanda?
Yeah, so Rwanda is another interesting case study because, so I look at three cases in this book. I compare Sierra Leone to Rwanda, and then the last case is the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'll come to that later. But Rwanda is a really important case because we have here the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which was set up in the 1990s, again, before the International Criminal Court. And the ICTR, so the Rwanda Tribunal, received a very different mandate than the ICC. So the ICTR's mandate was primacy. Oftentimes people, when they describe primacy, it's really the opposite of complementarity. Here the idea is that the International Tribunal has priority to prosecute, and it doesn't really have to worry about what domestic jurisdictions are doing. It didn't really have to worry about the Rwandan justice system. And this has come to be seen very negatively as sort of a very isolationist relationship between that tribunal, the Rwandan tribunal, and the Rwandan justice system. Now, and that later changed. Afterward, there was a procedural rule called Rule 11 bis that was adopted. I mean, we don't need to get into the details because this is less interesting. But then after that procedural rule was adopted and cases started being transferred from the Rwanda tribunal in Arusha back to the Rwandan justice system, this came to be seen very positively as complementarity in action. This was described very often in the literature as positive complementarity. There, the Rwanda Tribunal was working with the Rwandan authorities. Now, again, what my book tries to do is really trace these interactions between the Rwanda Tribunal, based in Arusha, Tanzania, and then the Rwandan justice system over a 20-year period. And by using, again, this vocabulary of iteration, accommodation, and isolation, it essentially nuances this very negative perception of primacy on the one hand, and then the very positive perception of complementarity. It's essentially saying, the book is essentially saying, it's more complicated than primacy bad, complementarity good. And I'm not going to get into sort of the details of the argument, but some of these issues might be interesting, just sort of from a socio-legal perspective, just a description of the things that happened in Rwanda. You know, one interesting example that I uncovered through my research is how the Rwandan authorities in the 1990s, so this was after the RPF came to power in 1994, it took control of the country, and oftentimes the RPF, so the government, this is the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which remains in power to this day, was very negatively predisposed to the ICTR. So there was a lot of tension between the Rwanda Tribunal in Arusha and then the new authorities in power in Rwanda. And they would complain oftentimes, the new authorities, about the ICTR stealing cases from the Rwandans. One very prominent case is Bagosora, who many years later was convicted and is currently in jail for genocide. But Bagosora was arrested in Cameroon at the request of the Rwandan authorities, and the ICTR came and said, look, we have primacy. You need to give us this case. Don't send Bagosora to Rwanda. And this is usually, you know, given as an example of the negative effects of primacy, that primacy really dissuaded the Rwandans from doing justice on their own terms domestically, which is of course partly true in this case. I mean, if you think about it in those terms, but primacy also had an underappreciated effect, which is that the threat of this happening forced the Rwandans to act more quickly in Rwanda. So they knew that there was this risk that, okay, if we wait too long, if we do not prosecute people, there were hundreds of thousands of people in pretrial detention awaiting trial in Rwanda, the ICTR could theoretically come and take these cases away. And so there was a brief period in this was 1995, 1996, that changed very quickly later on for a variety of reasons. But you know, I provide this example in the book to illustrate that it's not as simple as saying that primacy is just a bad thing. I mean, there are cases indeed where it did things. The mandate of the tribunal contributed to developments that are questionable. Today, people would assess this as a questionable decision to take this case away from Rwanda. But it also had other underappreciated effects. So that's one thing. The other thing that then, you know, the case study, the Rwanda case study gets into is sort of how the Rule 11 bis process unfolded. And here, you know, I'm adding a little bit to the literature, but this has been explored quite a bit by a variety of researchers. And most people agree that this process of sending cases back to Rwanda, so there were people who were indicted by the Rwanda tribunal who were in Arusha awaiting trial, and then international prosecutors decided, okay, we're going to send these cases back. That this whole process, sort of almost diplomatic negotiations that ensued over an extended period of time between prosecutors and judges in Arusha and then Rwandan prosecutors and judges in Kigali, that this was, generally speaking, a helpful experiment. I mean, there were huge tensions at the time, and if you look at the literature, it's not a simple story again of good or bad. The book really avoids those kinds of characterizations because these things are extremely complicated and very complex. But generally speaking, if you take a step back and now assess this with the benefit of hindsight, you realize that the interactions between these two levels helped push the process forward. So in Rwanda, one example that is oftentimes given is the fact that Rwanda abolished the death penalty. And scholars disagree. There's, you know, it's impossible to pinpoint why this happened. Some argue that it's not because of the ICTR, but I think the better view is, if you look at the totality of evidence, that this would not have happened when it did happen without the encouragement, the gentle encouragement of the Rwanda tribunal. And so these kinds of interactions between the international and the domestic level had certain positive effects for the Rwandan justice system. Also some maybe more questionable effects, but it's really a good example of how the international and the domestic level can interact and adjust their behavior in response to sort of what the other side is expecting. So yeah, I think I'll stop there. I don't know to what extent that example is clear, but I'm also happy to get into more details if that's useful.
No, I think that gives us a sense of what this looks like in Rwanda. And of course, it's worth reminding listeners that the book has loads more detail on all of these cases. So what we're doing now is, in some senses, a bit of a highlights tour, I suppose, to kind of get those big picture ideas. So the examples you're including, I think, help on that front, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Could I ask, the problem, of course, of that is that there's so many more questions I could ask about Sierra Leone or Rwanda. You know, there's so much more that we could go into, but I don't want to leave out the other country you investigate. So can we turn to the DRC?
Sure. Yeah. And the DRC, of course, is very important in this book because it is, this is the International Criminal Court. And the International Criminal Court is the court that is currently operating. The Special Court for Sierra Leone has shut down. The Rwanda Tribunal has shut down. So these are tribunals whose mandates have finished. The International Criminal Court, of course, is a permanent court that continues to operate. It continues to operate to this day in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Of course, it may at some point finish its investigation. We kind of expect that. At some point, it's been involved in the DRC for over 20 years now. But the ICC is important because this is where complementarity, this idea of complementarity, was born. And it's a case study. It's one of the best case studies that we have right now for how complementarity at the operates at the ICC. And my book takes a deep dive. I think it's fair to say that I did slightly more research on the Democratic Republic of Congo than I did on Sierra Leone and Rwanda, primarily because more research had already been done by other researchers in those other countries. And so I could really draw on an existing literature, whereas the DRC has been less studied. And myself, I worked there, so I was also drawing on my own experience in writing this book. But the DRC is interesting again for what it reveals about how the International Criminal Court operates in such a context. And of course, the ICC today is involved in 20 other countries, has open investigations, also preliminary examinations. And what we observe in the DRC is that the case distribution is primarily consensual, meaning what one observes there is that the ICC prosecutor seems to have reached some kind of tacit agreement. To what extent it's tacit or explicit, we don't really know because we don't have access to confidential documents. But there seems to be some kind of agreement whereby the ICC prosecutor gets cooperation from the host state authorities to prosecute a handful of people. So investigations are conducted from The Hague, evidence is collected, and then arrest warrants are issued. And then in the DRC, the authorities cooperated with these arrest warrants, transferred suspects to The Hague for prosecution. But in exchange for that, there seems to be also a reluctance on the part of the ICC prosecutor to really look at what the domestic justice system is doing. So there doesn't seem to be any trial monitoring process in place which would assess, okay, if whether, you know, the what the Congolese are doing domestically, prosecuting domestically, whether that is whether these prosecutions are genuine, whether this is something that maybe should be taken away from the Congolese because it does not meet fair trial standards or for some other reason is not genuine. And that kind of goes against the idea behind complementarity. Complementarity, initially, the way it's conceived in the Rome Statute, the way it's formulated in the Rome Statute, suggests that there should be some kind of interaction between the prosecutor and the domestic authorities. At least my research suggests that has not happened. Now, I kind of look at the cases that have been prosecuted domestically, and I coined this term in the book called unintended diversionary complementarity, which is my hypothesis about the effects that this has on the domestic justice system. And you know, it's a hypothesis that I developed based on the DRC case study, but I encourage other researchers working on the International Criminal Court to test whether this hypothesis holds in other contexts. So Venezuela, Colombia, there are a number of countries where we observe similar patterns. And the question is whether unintended diversionary complementarity is a real thing across the ICC's operations. And to summarize the argument is that because the ICC takes this hands-off approach, it doesn't want to sort of monitor or question what the domestic authorities are doing domestically, we see a pattern of prosecutions at the domestic level that target lower level, mid-level, and low-level perpetrators for certain crimes, but not other crimes. So, for example, isolated instances of rape as opposed to systematic rape. And so it creates impunity for the most serious perpetrators and more serious crimes. And, you know, this, again, the argument here is that it's unintended diversionary complementarity, because instead of focusing on the most serious crimes, the most serious perpetrators, what we see is the easier cases being dealt with domestically. Now, I should qualify that with one observation. This is not a critique of everything that's happened in the DRC. I think there's been a lot of activity, much like in Rwanda. A lot of cases have been prosecuted in the DRC, which is encouraging. This country, the DR Congo, compared to places like, for example, Sudan or Mali, where very few prosecutions have taken place, domestic prosecutions, is generally speaking a positive example of complementarity. So there is domestic activity. There is a genuine effort on the part of domestic prosecutors and judges to hold people accountable for serious crimes. That needs to be acknowledged. But the research also reveals that there is kind of a dark side that has been maybe neglected a little bit by us focusing too much on numbers. You know, how many people have been prosecuted in the DR Congo, as opposed to who gets prosecuted, why, and for what. So that's kind of one of the takeaways from that case study.
In that answer, you drew some comparisons with Rwanda, which I think are quite helpful for understanding this. And obviously within your answers before, between Sierra Leone and Rwanda, et cetera, if we sort of zoom out from the individual cases, what were some of the big picture trends that you noticed in doing this research overall?
Yeah, so this is, There are a few things that one observes. I should say that the research covers essentially a 25-year period. So the first tribunal, the Rwanda tribunal, was set up in 1994. At the end of 1994, it started operating a few months later. But up until my research ends in approximately 2020. And so it's taking stock in many ways of 25 years of developments in the field of international criminal law. And, you know, one big shift that I noticed based on these case studies and then also sort of the literature around these tribunals is rhetorical in nature. The big shift that this research draws attention to is how international criminal law is increasingly presented as something that is done together with state actors. So it's there to support the state in prosecuting international crimes through complementarity at the International Criminal Court. Whereas, you know, previously, especially with the Rwanda Tribunal, when it was set up, the assumption was that we're kind of acting against the state. The state is not to be trusted. The state is suspicious. It cannot do fair trials domestically. I'm describing this shift. I'm not now expressing an opinion about whether this shift is good or bad. It's just it's a complicated topic, but it's a real shift in the way we think about international criminal law and the role of international criminal tribunals versus domestic courts. Domestic courts are now seen as the first responders, the first line of defense, and that's a huge development in 25 years, and that has knock-on effects because increasingly the way international criminal law is rationalized is as almost a capacity building project. It's about building state capacity. So we need to make sure that domestic prosecutors and judges have the capacity to prosecute these serious crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. But what's missing oftentimes is a willingness to kind of to look, to peer beyond technical capacity building and ask, to what end? What is the goal? Why are we building this capacity aside from the unobjectionable goal, of course, of holding perpetrators of serious crimes to account? What is happening? What is the effect and what are the political effects of this focus on domestic justice? And here the book again uses both the Rwanda case study and the DRC case study, where lots of prosecutions happen domestically, to ask this question about what political effects has this had at the national level. And in particular, one of the concerns I express is that this may be promoting authoritarian tendencies, the use of criminal law, criminal punishment to deal with these serious crimes, to deal with, you know, legacies of abuse and injustice in contexts like Rwanda and the DRC, may paradoxically have not sort of an emancipatory but almost an authoritarian political side effect. And this is obviously most visible in Rwanda for people who are familiar with the Rwandan domestic context, the way in which the government in power that I mentioned earlier, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, has been able to use the criminal law to consolidate its authority. But even in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a very different context, I express I express certain concerns about the way in which criminal law is used, as I explained earlier, to prosecute certain people, but not other people. And oftentimes it's really the political elites, the people who are most connected, most well connected in that domestic context, who can escape the scrutiny of the courts. and thereby paradoxically, instead of challenging state power, impunity, we're creating a system whereby impunity persists for certain people. So you know, the research is really trying to kind of draw out these unintended effects, these unintended consequences. Nobody doubts that international criminal law has noble goals, holding people to account for the most serious crimes. These are unobjectionable goals, and I'm not trying to call into question people's motives, people who work on these issues. On the contrary, I consider myself as someone who belongs to that community and wants to use the law for progressive ends. But you, when you take a closer look at the research and the way in which these things operate in practice, there are questions that need to be asked, and questions that this book tries to ask.
And clearly quite important questions to ask. And I'm glad you discussed kind of those wider implications of what could be happening here. Is there anything that the ICC can or should do with this information?
So there are two ways to think about this. The first is that the book proposes various technical fixes, and many of these technical fixes have been proposed by other scholars, by civil society, and my book does this too. You know, so I look at the experiences of the Rwanda Tribunal, the Sierra Leone Court, the International Criminal Court in the DR Congo. I mean, I also draw on other cases to support my arguments. But you know, so I offer based on that sort of a few overarching technical fixes, you know, things that could be done by the ICC itself by amending, you know, its policies or changing its operations. One is, for example, having more experts from the countries where the crimes were committed. So always having local expertise is useful, because that means that when you're investigating crimes, you're aware of the contextual aspects, right? How does this relate to domestic politics and power? I also draw attention to sort of how the timing of intervention relates to a tribunal's freedom of action. One thing that we observe is that domestic actors, generally speaking, figure things out after a while. There's a lot of scope for healthy sort of push-pull relationships, as I call them, between the international and the domestic level in the early phases of intervention, when the ICC or another tribunal gets involved. And then that space for cooperation closes down very quickly, because both sides kind of figure out what the other side is willing or not willing to do. And then things kind of, you know, it becomes a more of an accommodationist approach, what I call, you know, this consensual accommodationist way of dealing with things. Another thing that I mentioned is, you know, engaging civil society actors in countries where crimes have been committed, making sure that civil society is involved so that they can interact with the government, with the international level, with donors. I also, you know, provide technical fixes with respect to the ICC's case law, but these are more sort of technical legal questions that I think are probably less interesting for, you know, a conversation like this. But then the other big thing that you know, this book is trying to do, and where it's trying to intervene in these scholarly debates, is to ask scholars, but you know, the ICC, donors, states who support international crimes prosecutions, NGOs, you know, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, to really kind of think more critically about this relationship between international tribunals and domestic courts. So, you know, going back to the beginning of this interview, it's oftentimes described as complementarity, positive complementarity, and this has this positive ring to it, this positive spin. But it's really an empty word in many ways. It's a word that gets thrown around by civil society, by states, by the ICC itself, in completely different ways. Everybody's using this word to mean completely different things. And it creates this confusion because, you know, diplomatically, everybody's happy. Okay, complementarity is taking place. But we need to ask ourselves deeper questions about what that means actually in practice. How are international and domestic actors working or not working together? And, you know, one thing that this book raises as a question is to what extent the turn, the emphasis on domestic courts, which is perceived very positively, right? This idea that domestic courts are the first line of defense, that's I would say, the conventional wisdom in the field of international criminal law today. It's an argument that's pushed by you know, Human Rights Watch, by states, by the International Criminal Court itself, is really such a healthy way of thinking about these questions? And to what extent does it really tie into this broader backlash against liberal internationalism, you know, multilateralism that we have been seeing now really for the last 10 years at least? A suspicion of international institutions, of multilateral cooperation. And the book is, I don't have good answers. I should really clarify this. You know, the book is an attempt to raise questions and ask whether the discourse in our field has missed something potentially. But I don't necessarily have a good answer to the questions that I'm raising. I'm concerned about the way in which we romanticize domestic prosecutions as a solution to impunity, to the most serious crimes. And there's a really robust critique of international institutions. And I'm querying whether we have gotten the balance there right, or if, you know, potentially scholars in particular, when I say we, I'm referring here to scholars, whether scholars are not contributing to a one-sided critique of the international level and kind of giving the domestic level a free pass.
That's, I think, such a great way to kind of sum up a lot of what the book is doing. And I think it's okay that there aren't great answers. I mean, we have to ask the questions before we can come up with answers. So thank you very much for taking us through that. As a final question, can I ask what you might be working on now that this book is done?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I mean the book, I finished the book and I am still working on a few connected issues looking at... I'm involved in this as a scholar, but also as a practitioner, as somebody who's promoting various international crimes initiatives in the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and also in Sudan. And so I'm continuing to observe and think and write about how these processes are playing out in these contexts. And more recently, I've gotten involved also in the Ukrainian context and coming, you know, from that region and trying to compare how an interstate war between, you know, Russia and Ukraine in this case is different from the civil war context that I studied that I'm familiar with from the African continent. So that's one thing that I'm thinking about. And the other bigger issue is also double standards in international law. I mean, this is something that we hear a lot about today, especially with with the war currently ongoing in Palestine and Gaza. Critiques of liberal internationalism, the double standards of the West, and here I'm drawing a little bit on my earlier work in Africa, where this critique of the West colonial legacies, the selectivity of international criminal law, the fact that it has up until recently focused primarily on African perpetrators, African victims, to the exclusion of crimes committed by Western actors, how, you know, all these things are coming together. And you know, I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done on double standards in international law, and I'm hoping to contribute to that conversation.
Well, that sounds quite interesting. So best of luck with that. And thank you for that little sneak preview. While you're working on that topic, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled International Criminal Tribunals and Domestic Accountability in the Court's Shadow, published by Oxford University Press. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the book.